What I want to do today, yesterday we talked more about sort of the physical meaning and the intuition of histories-based approach to quantum mechanics. Today it's going to be basically mathematical formalism. What I want to do is to start to construct this dictionary to show you how to get back from this different starting point to the other starting point that you're more familiar with, which is based on operators, Hilbert spaces, state vectors, the Schrodinger equation, and so on. So I think that we, in fact, I'm sure that I won't have time to go to the end of that, but I want to try to do things, set things up carefully so that if you want, you can carry through the rest yourself and you can get some also. Most of the details are in those notes that were distributed if you want to follow it to the bitter end. Before I do that, though, maybe I should ask, are there any questions from yesterday, or I guess even from this morning, although, of course, I wasn't here this morning. It appears that it applies to things more general than unitary theories, and for my own, in my own mind, that's also important for gravity, because I don't, and many of us, don't expect gravity to be ultimately described by a unitary theory, although the number of people with that expectation seems to be going down with time, not up. The context I want to work in is the simplest possible, and the one that you probably mainly have in mind when you're studying non-relativistic or sort of introductory quantum mechanics, which is particle mechanics. So we imagine that we have one or more particles described by world lines, gamma, which I'll call gamma. You can think of gamma as being either a single world line, in which case we can view it as a map of the real numbers. If you imagine it without a beginning, without an end, then we can think of it as a map of the real numbers into, if we're just in 3 + 1 dimensions, into Euclidean space R3. That's a single world line. If we're dealing with many particles, then we could think of it as a map into R3n, where n is the number of particles. In other words, one set of spatial coordinates for each of the particles, right? And then all the rest of the dynamics is described by the Lagrangian. I mean, I should say the dynamics is described by the Lagrangian, which includes a kinetic energy term. And then all the rest of the dynamics, which is the interactions among the particles, is just described by a non-trivial choice of the potential energy term, V of Q and T. Q here, of course, represents, I'm using the notation, common notation, Q for the point in configuration space, in the simplest case, just the point in 3 space that the particle assumes at time T. Okay, so I assume this is all very standard, but stop me if there's any questions on any of this. So in a more general case, where you could have a magnetic field, but I'm going, and those look like, in a sense, velocity-dependent potentials in the Lagrangian. But I'm, for simplicity, going to, although it wouldn't make much difference to include it, I'm going to leave it out. That, I assume, is probably, so how many people are familiar with how to include magnetic fields in this? Sort of, so how many are most? How many are not familiar? So maybe majority, maybe two-thirds are familiar. You have to introduce something called the vector potential, such that its curl is equal to B and so on. So it complicates things a little, but it's obviously very important for atomic physics, where the magnetic fields are present. But anyway, so it fits into this just by a change to the Lagrangian. But from now on, I'll ignore it. So now we'll introduce this. Oh, I see. So does this, I see, in order to move this, you have to. Okay. So I'll introduce then the space of all these world lines or histories. So gamma, we'll call a history. The space of all these world lines is called usually omega, the space of all histories. And we'll often be considering truncated histories, that is, where we cut them off at some initial time t0, t1, let's say, and some final time, say, t2. And if we do that, then I'll write something like omega t1, omega t2. This consists of histories, still function gamma, but now they map the time interval t1, t2 into R3 or R3n, as the case may be. And you can, there are intermediate cases where you cut them off in the future, but not in the past. The next notion that we need is the notion of event. So an event, usually I'll write them as A, B, and so on. They're sets of histories. So in other words, they're subsets of the space omega. Okay. So if you think back to yesterday, we were dealing with diffraction experiments like this, for example, and then the space of histories was all the possible trajectories of the diffracting particle, and the events were things like it goes through this slit and ends up at this detector or something like that. And that's, as you can see, that's a set of histories because it corresponds to all the histories that do that, and it excludes all the histories that don't do that, say this history, whichever event you have in mind. In fact, if you think about the meaning of the word event in ordinary everyday language, it actually corresponds very well to this mathematical usage, like the one that always I think of as rain. It's raining this afternoon, so that's an event. This event isn't actually happening, but it's an event that we can conceive of. And if you think what that means, it corresponds to a certain number of trajectories of the rain particles, the raindrops, or whatever your fundamental objects are in the theory, all of those in which the raindrops happen to be descending from the sky and so on. Whereas other events, the other possibilities, like the event it's not raining, corresponds to another set of trajectories for the raindrop. So that, anyway, that's a standard terminology. And now the basic quantity from which everything else is supposed to follow is this quantum measure, mu, which takes an event, and gives you a real number out. And that real number under certain circumstances can be interpreted as a probability, but in general it cannot. When it's a probability, of course, it's a positive real number between 0 and 1. But in general, it's always a positive real number. But it, as we discussed, with some of us discussed after the last class, it need not be between 0 and 1. That is, it could be, in some cases, greater than 1. Oh, no, I still have you. I'll say in a second the situation, I'll remind you of the situation in which we do know that this is a probability. But let me first give its general formula. So all of these histories-based theories have a particular form for the measure. So remember that this A is a set of histories. So let me think of them. Let me just pretend for the moment that they're a finite set, even though in the real case, because we have world lines and continuously variable world lines, in the real case, it's a continuous space. It has an infinite number of elements. But let's suppose for a moment that it's a finite set and use that notation. Then the way you form this measure is you sum over all the trajectories, all the histories in the event whose measure you're trying to compute, some particular thing which depends on pairs, not on individual histories. So it's a kind of joint amplitude. In some of the literature, it's known as the decoherence functional, that this is a kind of joint amplitude for the pair of histories. And then we sum over all the histories, gamma 2, all the pairs, gamma 1 and gamma 2, which belong to that event whose measure we're interested in. Usually, because instead of writing all these subscripts, it's more convenient to use a bar, so I'll call them pairs of histories, gamma and gamma bar. Of course, we can call them anything, but I'll usually use this notation. And then the whole, we saw yesterday what that meant. So if this was gamma 1, for example, and this was gamma 2, we saw that this contribution, if you remember when we did the two slit, we wrote out the amplitude, the total probability to arrive at a given detector as a sum of four terms. Coming from the two slits. And these are those four terms. So they're like products of amplitudes belonging to the two trajectories in question. But one thing that I didn't stress yesterday, or didn't mention at all perhaps, is that we always considered it in the case where they had the same final endpoint. If they have different final endpoints, then they don't contribute. There's no interference between, as you might know, there's no interference between trajectories that have different final locations. Of course, you might say, what do I mean by final locations? Time doesn't stop. And that's an important point. And we'll come back to that very quickly. But let me write this down now. So any sort of histories-based theory is defined by one of these pairs, and it has certain properties like it's Hermitian and so on, but I won't bother to do it in general. Let me just write it down what it is in the case that we're interested in. Okay. So this is like the master formula for non-relativistic quantum mechanics. So now we'll write it as an integral because it's an integral over pairs. Just like before, I wrote it as a sum, but now it's really this past integral over pairs of world lines or pairs of histories. Whenever I say world line, you can think, if I'm in the many particle case, you can think many world lines or a single world line in the higher dimensional configuration space. Okay. And then there's this thing in which the Lagrangian enters. So it's e to the is of the world line. And then the second world line, the one that comes in the second place of this d, is, I can do it like this. And then the somewhat peculiar thing, which is a delta function which sets the final endpoints equal. So this is just saying, there's a certain time, I've introduced here a certain time t, which I call truncation time, because it's the time on which we've stopped time, or time in which we've cut the paths off. And I've demanded in this delta function that the two paths have the same endpoint. So in other words, I'm considering paths with, in this case, I wrote them with no beginning. They're going on, but they're coming to some final time t, and capital T, and then there's the second path, gamma and gamma bar. In a situation like this, this pair of paths gives no contribution to this measure. The only thing that does contribute is this kind of pair, right? So the two have to be glued together or sewn together at the final endpoint. And sometimes in the picture, to indicate which one is which is the first argument, that is, which has the e to the is, and which has the e to the minus is, it's convenient to use arrows like this and think of this in some way as a path. You can think of it as a path going forward in time and then turning around and coming back in time. That's a convenient imagery for it, what's going on. But I should mention, it shouldn't be confused with the idea of antiparticles. So these are not I'm not doing quantum field theory here. These are just particles. But in a certain sense, they're forming closed time paths, or paths that loop back in time. Anyway, it's just a notation at this point to show you which one has which amplitude. Okay, is there a question? Yeah. Yes, good question. Yes, so that's a very deep question. So the first question is, why do we do this at all? And I don't have a good answer. Why do we truncate them like this at all? And I don't have a good answer to that. That's just the way quantum mechanics is. But at the same moment, we don't really think that time stops. So there must be something arbitrary about this choice of truncation time. And we'll see in a little bit that the demand, that the answers in the end not depend on where we chose this time, is equivalent to, in this setting, it's equivalent to the requirement of unitarity. And so that's one comment. The comment, why don't we choose an initial time? Well, that's just, so the really deep answer would be difficult, and I'm not sure that I understand it fully. It's certainly related to the second law of thermodynamics. It's the fact that we tend to, so I haven't told you yet what we do in the beginning. So implicit in this is some sort of initial conditions, which I haven't spelled out. So I think ultimately, the initial conditions come from cosmology. That means that if there's a beginning at all, then it's a cosmological beginning. And really, you only get them by extending this to full quantum gravity and saying what the universe must have began like. And all that is sort of hidden in this. What we'll see very soon is that it doesn't matter too much what the initial conditions are, because we can sort of get a fresh start at some point, which I could call here now T naught, by describing everything, by forget throwing away the details of the past and just putting in here a wave function. So in fact, what we're going to end up doing in practice, I wanted to give it in full generality here, but in practice what we'll end up doing is having the initial condition described by a wave function, or more generally density matrix, but I won't worry about that now, and the final condition described by this trace type condition, meaning there is no final condition. So there are initial conditions, but no final. So that was a crucial question, or at least the question points to a crucial aspect of this. There's no final condition other than this delta function itself, which is not a final condition on the individual path, but it's a final condition that ties the two trajectories together. Yeah.
Why do we normally not see the delta function in the prescription for the Feynman amplitude and the probability?
Because normally you don't see that, because normally people take a slightly different point of view. They say, let's specify the initial condition and specify the final condition, and specify it to be a particular point and a particular point, and then they limit themselves only to those trajectories that go from that specified initial point to that specified final point. So when you're doing that, then the delta function basically collapses. You don't see it explicitly.
So you're saying that if we do not take such a radical approach and consider a more general set of events, which we do not, well, say trajectories, we do not have a specified point in space, specified final point.
Yes.
Then if we want to calculate the probability, we cannot just take all pairs.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. And in some sense, you're familiar, depending on how familiar with it. But you know, when people do scattering experiments, for example, they talk about the cross section to go a certain output. You know, to. But let me even do it simple. Suppose we go back to our diffraction experiment. You know, I always had this detector. I just sort of drew it as D or something. But suppose that there was the detector was actually, which it always is, of some spatial extent, and you wanted to know. You wanted to know the probability for it to fire. So that's the probability for the particle to end up anywhere in this interval or this region, not just at a single point. And then if you actually work that out, what would you do in using the usual definitions that you've probably seen? What you would do is you'd work out the probability to come to this point and the probability to come to this point and the probability of this point. That is, you'd work out some sort of final wave function at this time t, and you'd square it and integrate it dq, where q belongs to this little region here, right? So the truth is that the probability that you compute is not just the square of some amplitude, it's the sum of squares of amplitude. In fact, almost, maybe I should make a historical comment. The large majority of what I'm telling you now is in some sense contained in Feynman's original paper on the path integral. Not quite in the same way, but the basic ideas are all there. But there's one thing that's a mistake in that paper, if you take it literally, which it says that the probability should always be squares of amplitudes. That's not really true. What's really true is that probabilities are squares, sums of squares of amplitudes. Because when you have these so-called inclusive cross-sections, or these, when you're considering a range of possible outcomes, then this is the more general form. And so that this formula actually just captures that fact.
Excuse me, maybe I'm not understanding. If we consider such an event, like particle going at at some point of this interval, this is an event, we can calculate its amplitude and then square its modulus and obtain probability. What's wrong about it?
Well, there's a different, right, so suppose I were to add up the amplitudes for all the possible endpoints here within this region to which the detector is sensitive, then I would produce something like the integral of psi of q dq where Q is in some sort of little region delta, which I've called this thing. I was just seeing if we had colored chalk, but anyway. I call this region delta, where the detector is sensitive. This would be this, right? And then you would add this up and square it. But that's obviously not the same thing as this. So there's a difference between adding the amplitudes first and then squaring it, and squaring the amplitudes and then adding.
Like, but
that answer?
The actual physical probability of the event will be like the right hand side or left hand side?
Left hand side. It'll actually be this.
I mean, the difference is whether we are able to distinguish in principle the different outcomes of the experiment. So if in this case we imagine that we are able to distinguish the different positions, but we do not care. So we integrate a square. But if we were not able to do it in principle, we would square the integral.
I don't think it has to do with what we're able to distinguish, but it does have to do with the functioning of the detector. So, of course, if the detector made some coherent superposition of these and was sensitive to that, then you'd get a different formula which would involve some sort of response function of the detector that would be neither this nor this. So I'm assuming that the detector essentially decoheres the different spatial locations in this case. Does that answer? OK, so let's go on.
Excuse me, Justin.
Yeah.
I have a question. Did you really want to specify mu of A again? Or should this be a D of gamma gamma R?
Here, this is supposed to be the complete specification of mu of A. So its relation to D is that whatever lies under the sum is D. So another way that I could have said this is that D of gamma and gamma bar is equal to whatever this is. So it's equal to e to the I s of gamma times e to the minus I s of gamma bar times delta of gamma bar t minus gamma t. So this is somehow the key thing. This joint amplitude for the history is gamma and gamma bar is given by this strange, somewhat strange formula that's strange for two reasons. What's the question?
I have another question.
Okay, let me finish this then. So this is strange for two reasons. First of all, because so this amplitude depends jointly on gamma and gamma bar, but it's in a very simple form. It's basically just the product of one factor that depends only on gamma and one only on gamma bar. So to that extent, you might say that there's no quote-unquote interaction between gamma and gamma bar. On the other hand, there is an interaction, but it's a very peculiar kind of interaction. It's a very violent sort of interaction. It's a delta function. And what's more peculiar than that is that it depends on this auxiliary time that I've introduced, t. And the rules for this t are that it must be sufficiently far to the future so that the terms that I wrote down all make sense. T sufficiently great so that the events A that I'm talking about make sense. So here's a sort of diagrammatic representation of what I've written down there for mu. So I represent A as just a blob here. You could think of it as a set of slits or something that the particle must negotiate. T is the truncation time, and then I represent the path gamma to show that it satisfies the condition A. It goes, it belongs to the event A. I'll show it as growing through A, and so on. Same for the gamma bar. And the point is that this A is some set of conditions on the history. But those conditions are specified at a time or over a range of times. And this time t that enters into the formula must be to the future of that. But it doesn't have to be exactly there, right? It could be chosen later, and we'd get a different set of events, different set of trajectories contributing. And the answer, for consistency, the answer must be the same. And then we'll come back to that, and that'll show us where unitarity comes from, or what the meaning of unitarity is within this framework. Okay, so is it, there was, yeah.
I just wondered how the event A entered into the interval there, because we integrate over omega.
Yes. That's a crucial observation. I should have written, but did not write. That gamma and gamma bar also belong to A, right? Yeah, without that, it's a nonsense. Well, it's not nonsensical, but without that, it belongs to one particular event, which is the event omega itself, which basically is the event that anything happens whatsoever. It's the unit event, the universal event, which we'll be coming back to also. Okay, yeah, thanks for that. So this is the whole point of the formula. Okay, so the only thing I need further is to tell you what D nu of gamma is. I won't tell you because I think Adrian has already told you what it was. So if to give it a precise meaning, we have to divide up time into a, at least the way that it's normally given precise meaning, people try to do better, but the way that it's traditionally done is you divide up time into a series of times separated by a small interval delta t, and then you instead of gamma being a continuous path, a just continuously defined path, you think of it as having just a sequence of locations. So it's as if you made it to be a zigzag straight line path, and then you represent it by sort of locations q1, q2, and so on. And then d gamma is some sort of product of some constant, depending on the mass and so on, of the particle, which is not what you've already seen. But the thing I want to stress is that it has in here 1 over the square root of delta t. That'll be important when you come to actually compute the Hamiltonian. So it's the product of all of the i's from 1 to n. So this is, see the earlier lecture notes for the details. I think that when I looked at the lecture notes, Adrian did it only for I think he did it only for the free particle, but it's the same expression exactly is valid for the free particle. That is, it's valid. It also works when the potential is not zero. In other words, where you have interacting particles or a particle in a background potential. This thing here is called the measure factor or the integration measure. It's the thing which you need to give actual meaning to that path integral. And if you read people who work on path integrals, often, for example, people, it's just a burning issue in quantum gravity in the Regge calculus approach. The question is, what is the right choice for the measure factor? And that's not that's really part of the physical input that needs to be given in any particular case. But in the case of in the case of non-relativistic quantum mechanics, we know if we represent the paths in this time-sliced way, lattice-sized time, then we know the choice for it. And it's related to unitarity. Okay, so I think everything that takes care of everything. So were there any questions on this general setup?
Yeah, what's above the square root of the delta t?
Oh, that's supposed to say constant.
Okay.
Just some constant.
Should it be some v lambda?
What's that?
Or dq's or whatever.
What does d lambda mean?
No, I mean dq.
Oh, I see what you mean. Yes, that's also, of course, absolutely right. It should have a dq. It should have.
Di.
Dqi. Yes. It's the product of dqi. But other questions, corrections? Okay, so now I wanted to make a remark, which is that, all experimental predictions so far, I put here so far because we don't know what generalizations may emerge ultimately from this, in particular in connection with quantum gravity. But all experimental predictions so far are contained in this formula. When we apply it to a particular case, by taking A, particular choice for the event A. What is that event A? What are those events? If you think how you actually do using the usual paradigm, if you think the kind of measurements that people have in mind, laboratory measurements, as a sort of cartoonish kind of picture that we have, which is that we start with some sort of measuring device, or some readout device, let's say. It starts out in some ready state before it gives the answer, you know, it's set up to be about to read out, ready to read out the answer. And then when it gets the answer, then it goes into some other state, the so-called pointer points in some other direction, say this direction, or this direction. Suppose there were three possible outcomes, then you think of the pointer going from this ready state to the output. So the actual result of that particular run of the experiment is expressed by a motion of the pointer from one location to another location. And that's an event. So that's a pointer event. It says that the world lines followed a certain trajectory, the world lines of the atoms making up the pointer followed a certain rough coarse-grained trajectory. They either went from here to here or from here to here or so on. Those are three possible events. And if we compute the measures of those events, which I'll call pointer events or instrument events, or in this case, it's a pointer event, then in that case, mu of A is the, then mu of A is interpreted. So I'm just translating for you the usual rules. Mu of A becomes, let's say, the probability of that outcome. So I'm repeating what I said yesterday, which was that in situations where we're dealing with pointer events or instrument events, or more generally macroscopic events, this mu actually is a probability. So A could be, for example, the pointer move to, what did I say, position 3 at noon, or some, just to make some whimsical choice. Therefore, okay, so if what I'm telling you is true, and I believe it is true, then everything else that we use in quantum mechanics to derive probabilities of experimental outcomes must actually be contained somehow in this mu of A. And then the rest of this, what I want to tell you, is to begin to see how it's all contained in mu of A. So the first, what's the first thing? First thing I want to do is to get psi itself. So let's go toward the wave function. So far all we have is this measure. We have this space of histories. We have a quantum measure on it, given by this certain particular rule there, the delta function in it, and so on. So what is it that makes it possible to introduce the wave function? What makes it possible is, this is so high, I can't even see it myself. What makes it possible is that particular product form together with the delta function. That means, remember I had this picture here. I had this picture here. Let's simplify it. These are single, not two different superimposed versions of the picture. So you see, I'm computing a sum over these pairs, but because these two pairs only meet at one point, I can sort of split it, and I can compute from each path, I can compute a wave function, which one will be the complex conjugate of the other, and then I can multiply them together and integrate over the final endpoint, Q, and that'll be the same result. So that's pictorially what's going on. So let me do this in a terms of formulas. So I take this delta function that was there, which was, remember, delta of gamma of t and gamma minus gamma bar of t. I'm just going to split it into two delta functions. So I'm going to do a trick here. I'm going to insert a factor of 1 into the expression there. Represented in a very particular way. I'm going to represent it as the integral dq. So I had delta of gamma of t minus gamma bar of t. I'll just write that as gamma of q minus gamma of t and gamma of q minus gamma bar of t and integrate over dq. Okay, so that's equal to 1, or more precisely, this is equal to that, as you can see, because when I integrate over q, I can think of doing this integral, and then the effect of that integrating over the delta function is just to substitute for q here this expression gamma of t, right? So that's straightforward. So let's substitute that in to the expression up on the top there. This expression. So what do we get? We now get mu of A. Now we have this integral dq. Everything else is the same, except that we now have two delta functions. So d nu of gamma, e to the I s of gamma, just as before. Now, one of the halves of the delta function, gamma of t minus q. And now another complementary integral, integral d nu of gamma bar. Gamma bar is now in A also. Of course, I haven't bothered now with saying that it's in omega. It's also, I just mentioned that it's in A. E to the minus I s of gamma bar and the delta function of q minus gamma bar of t. So now I give this a name. What happened? There was no color chart? Was that the story? It's not crucial, I just wondered.
I can see if
it's... Oh, it doesn't matter. So this is now where the wave function... So see, I've split this into two terms, multiplied together and integrated with the total integral over q, this auxiliary parameter that I introduced that represents... Oh, I got used to these. Represents that q in the diagram there. So I can now just give this a name of psi of q and t, whereas I put this t here to remind, so we remind ourselves that we got it from choosing the truncation time at t. And then with that definition, if you stare at that and you stare at this, this is just the complex conjugate of that expression. And so we have psi of q and t star. Okay. And so the result is that mu is equal to the integral dq of psi of q and t squared. And I can call this, also as a reminder that this came from the event A, I can call it psi sub A of Q and T. So what's the conclusion? The conclusion is that we can rewrite, so this is related to the question that came up earlier about why we don't use the sum of the amplitudes squared. The conclusion is that we can rewrite this measure as the norm, this is called the L2 norm sometimes, for those who are familiar with it, as the norm of this, or the norm squared of this wave function defined at the time capital T, this truncation time. So psi sub A of Q and T, it summarizes the past in the sense, i.e., in this case, the event A that went into the definition. And it's also, it summarizes it to the extent that we need to compute the measure, quantum measure mu. And it's also, so it's a summary that's useful for, one, for first of all, computing mu of A. And second of all, for future predictions, I'll call them, by which I really just mean computing the measures of events in the future. So let's see the second thing. That'll lead us basically to the Schrödinger equation. Oops. Okay, so how do we do this? So now I want to, here's the picture that goes with what I'm talking about. So we had an event A whose measure we wanted. We had this truncation time, which I'll take to be another, an intermediate time, and then we'll have a true final truncation time. And we'll have an event B here. And so we're trying to compute measure using these kinds of paths. So there's an event A that happens, and then there's an event B that happens at some later time after T1. And we're interested in the event A from event E, which is sort of A and B. So A happens and B happens. So the histories should satisfy this condition, and then they should satisfy this condition as well. So it's some sort of composite event. But now I can split it. I can write out that same expression, and I can split it into not splitting the path here, which is what I did to get the wave function, but split both paths at the time t1, and we'll be able to see how the wave function at the time t1 serves as an initial condition for computations to the future of T1. So it's the same trick. So let's consider now this mu of A and B. That's integral. Well, we just saw that I can compute that as an integral of a wave function psi A and B at Q and T2 squared. Okay, right. That's just what we proved in general. So now the question is, what is this psi A? Psi of AB of Q and T2. So split the paths, gamma and gamma bar, at T1, using the same trick as before. Take a delta function. Well, it's a little bit more complicated now. We imagine the initial portions of, let me draw another picture for this actually. So now I'm interested just in resolving this, I'm just interested in dealing with this wave function, A, psi, AB, from which we can compute the total measure. So now I only have to deal with a single path, T2, T1, here's event A. Here's event B. So I'm now interested in this class of paths, which end up at the particular point Q. It's this. In fact, I should have said maybe that the event psi, that the wave function psi, when I introduced it, corresponds to histories like this is a picture for psi itself. It's the result of all, it's the sum. It's if you like, it's just the net amplitude to arrive at Q at time t through via the event A. And so now I'm doing the same thing to get psi at time t2 via the event A and B. So when I split the two things together, when I split the delta function, when I think of these paths as two independent paths, the one before t1 and the one after t1, and then glue them together with a delta function at t1, and then split that delta function, then we get the following expression. So I think the words I said were kind of confusing, more confusing than they needed to be. But I think the picture is very clear. At least I hope the picture is clear. And the result, as you can easily check for yourself, if it's not obvious from the picture, is psi b of q2 and t2 is equal to the integral dq1. That's the time, that's this point at which I've split the two paths where they're joined together, of the integral of gamma and I better not forget this time to put that gamma also belongs to B. So what I've done is sort of temporarily imagine to stop time here, produce a wave function, and then keep going. And you can see that the whole answer will depend only on that initial wave function. And this is the actual formula for it. D nu of gamma delta Q2, Q1 it should be. No, Q2, sorry, minus gamma of Q2, e to the I, S of gamma, delta, gamma of T1, minus Q1, times psi A of Q. Oh, I see. Q and T. Q1 and T1. Okay. So is it clear?
So does it mean that
we have to function what is argument of Q?
What is this out?
Yes, argument of Q.
This is the argument of the wave function that
index
final
two is one or two.
Sorry, this?
Yes.
Two. It's two.
And that one in delta function is in delta function.
Which one?
This one, index of Q.
This is, yeah, this is saying that at the final time T2, that you should be in position. I should have written, this is 2, if you like. This should be a 2. Then it should be propagating by e to the is. And then it started at the location Q1 at time T1, which is where it has arrived from the earlier times. Okay, so I believe this is correct. This is supposed to be 1 also. So I see we actually have a force. Let me write this as, you see what this is doing. It's giving us the wave function at the time t2 in terms of the wave function at time t1, the intermediate time, and some expression here, which I've isolated, which is normally called the propagator. So what we have done is derive the propagator. So this whole expression here, everything except everything that multiplies that wave function, and except for the integral itself, this is the this is something I'll call u for the propagator. I'll put a subscript b on it because it involved only the paths that belong to b, and it depends on two endpoints: q2 t2 and q1 T1. Okay, so this is the key thing that enters all the subsequent formulas. We think the normal words are used for that are used for it would be something like the amplitude to propagate from Q1 at T1 to Q2 at T2. The only thing that might look a little unfamiliar here is I'm not summing over all the paths in doing this propagator, but I'm just summing over those that satisfy the condition that defines the event B. Okay, if you thought of, so certain slits and so on, then it would be those paths that went through that combination of slits. So the upshot is that psi, so this is somehow a key formula, is that psi AB of Q2 and T2 is equal to the integral of this propagator via B of Q2, T2, Q1, T1 times psi sub A of Q1 and T1. dQ1. So somehow all the results which I was hoping to get to, but obviously, well, I knew I wouldn't get to all of them, but I think I'm not even getting quite as far as I hoped. But all of those results follow somehow from this formula together with the variational formulas, the Lagrangian formulas and so on, that I think you went over in the tutorial this morning. Now, what is this to do with unitarity? So remember, I said that we wrote this formula, and I said that it involves an arbitrary time, capital T, this truncation time. But that time is arbitrary. It's not totally arbitrary, because if you look up there, it has to be to the future of when the event A is defined. But otherwise, it's arbitrary. So that means that if I go and compute the measure using a different, if this formula is consistent, physically consistent, it means that if I compute the measure using a later truncation time, I must get the same answer. So if I go from t to a later time, t2, which is greater than t1, then mu of A must not change. That is to say, if I take B equal, I mean, if I want to apply my previous formulas, if I take B to be equal, the event B, here's the event, I don't know which score this is. If I take this event B to be the trivial event that just says that anything whatsoever happens, it puts no restriction on the integral, on the paths after T1, then I'm just computing the measure of A a second time, and therefore I must get the same result. So if I take this B equals 1, then mu A and B must equal mu of A, which is just another way of saying that I can push the truncation time to the future without changing anything. Now, let me write it out fully. Okay, so if I say that mu of A, so let's take that mu of A is equal to mu of A and B, in this special case where B is putting no restriction. What was mu of A? That's the integral. See, remember that we saw that the measure mu of A is just the sum, it's just the norm of the wave function computed at the time t, where the wave function is the one we produce from the event A. If we compute the same wave function at a later time t, we should get the same thing. So what it is basically is a condition of conservation of norm of the wave function. Okay. So, which is, won't surprise you, is some form of unitarity. But let's write it out in full. So psi of A of Q1 T1 squared dQ1, that's the mu of A as we computed it over on the right. That has to be the integral of psi sub A and B, but now B is trivial. Q2 of T2 squared dQ2. If I write out what the right-hand side is in detail, it's psi A of Q2 T2 and psi A, the same thing, complex conjugate, dQ2, that's equal to, now let me pull out the dQ integral and express these in terms of the propagated wave function from time T1. So that's psi A, that's U of Q2, T2, Q1, T1, psi A, Q1, T1, dQ1. And then the same thing again, I'll just abbreviate, U of Q, I'll leave out the T just to save time. And this is another independent dummy variable, Q2 prime, complex conjugate now, psi A, Q1 prime star dQ1 prime. Then just multiply, rearranging the integrals, I have the integral dQ1, did I leave out the dQ? dQ1, dQ1 prime, taking out the wave function, psi A, Q1, psi A, Q1 prime, star, rearranging that. And then I have the integral of dQ2, U, I'll put back the times now, Q2, T2, Q1, T1, U, Q2, T2, Q1 prime, T1, star. Okay? We want this whole thing on the left-hand side, we just want it to be the integral of psi, psi star, dQ, 1. This, we want this to equal this. How can that happen? Well, the way that that can happen, these are now evaluated at the same point, Q1. Of course, the way that that can happen, basically the only way that that can happen is for this thing to reduce to a delta function. That'll force Q and Q1 to Q1 prime to be equal. So in other words, we need integral dQ to this all expect, well, can I somehow do, we need this, I don't know how to draw, continue the arrow from here down to the next board, we need this to equal delta of Q1 minus Q1 prime. So what if you read this as a matrix equation, what is it saying? It's saying that this matrix, so the integration variable here is Q2. So I could write it in the other order. I'd have Q2, Q1 prime. The integration variable is Q2. So if I reverse the arguments here, then I have, and because there's a star here, this is the definition of the adjoint matrix, the Hermitian conjugate matrix. And so I have the Hermitian conjugate of U and the integration variable Q2 times U should be equal to 1. So it's a matrix equation. It's saying U dagger U is equal to 1. So this is the consistency condition for our whole definition. Now, is this unitarity? It's obviously close to unitarity, but is it exactly unitarity? So it's not, because we're in infinite dimensions, right? So if we were in finite dimensions, this would say that U was invertible, and it would say that U has to be a unitary matrix. In infinite dimensions, there's another condition, which is that U circle U dagger also equals 1. Where I've defined, maybe for those who are not familiar with the definition, I've defined U dagger of Q, Q1, T1, Q2, T2. That's just, as always, defined by reversing the argument. Something bothering me. Okay. Yes, okay. So that's the definition. So in general, you know, the definition is U of JK, U dagger of JK is U dagger of KJ star. That's just the definition of unitarity. In fact, so we can see just maybe this whole, maybe the derivation was slightly confusing, more than it needs to be. So I can I can extract the essence of it.
Maybe a short question. And the derivation when you got the U and U dagger, U and U star in this order.
Yes.
It's not obvious why you wouldn't have, you couldn't kind of reverse the order the way you would.
Sorry? Here?
Yeah.
Well, these are just numbers. I can reverse the order. Yeah. Is that what you mean?
Sorry.
Yeah, the question is answered? Okay. Let me just summarize that because we're running out of time. This step. So I want to. I'm just repeating the derivation now in a somewhat more schematic notation. So what we did is we computed the. So that by this A2, I mean, but before what I called psi A of Q2, T2. So I'll just notate that more simply like this, and we showed that that was equal to some sort of U2 1 times psi times A. 1 times the A, psi A, evaluated at time 1. Therefore, that when I take its norm, I'm using here this Dirac notation that I guess everyone is familiar with. Is it true? Is that a familiar notation to people? Okay. So when I take the norm A2, A2, I just get A1, U2, 1, dagger, U, 2, 1, A, 1. And I've said that this must have to equal, because the measure was defined independently of my choice of the truncation time, this has to equal a1, a1. So if this has to equal this, the only, in general, the only way that this can happen is that u21 dagger u21 equals 1, which, of course, in coordinates is represented as a delta function. So this is just a short summary of the essence of the derivation that I just went through. What we found is that this u dagger u had to equal a delta function somewhere here, this delta function. The delta function, of course, is the representation of the unit matrix in the continuum. So in any case, the result is the same, that u dagger u has to equal 1. And that's half of unitarity, or a large part of unitarity. But in fact, if you want full unitarity in the infinite case, you have to add this condition. So the result, the conclusion is that we force, for consistency, we need to assume a almost unitarity. If we go further and just add in that we will ask it to be unitary, then we're back to ordinary quantum mechanics. Now, I shouldn't have to just add it in because I've written ordinary quantum mechanics. And that's because the reason that we haven't seen unitarity is because that it's something very subtle and hard to establish simply from these general forms. It depends very much on the choice of the integration measure that we talked about before and the form of the Lagrangian. So in general, it's not guaranteed that you just write down any crazy Lagrangian that you'll get unitary evolution. If you don't even get this, you won't even have a consistent theory. But if you want a unitary theory, you need, in addition, this. Normally, I don't know of any realistic cases where you get this without this, but one could imagine it. Anyway, let's assume both of them. When we assume both of them, then it means that U inverse exists also and is equal to, of course, is equal to the Hermitian adjoint of U. Okay, so I think we arrived not quite as far as I was hoping. But so the important thing is that U inverse now exists, and that allows us to formally go backward in time as well as forward. So since I think we're more or less out of time, let me just say in words how the rest of the thing goes. First, I want to show you, I just want to show you briefly how, having got this propagator, we get the Schrodinger equation. Now, we're able to propagate, if you look at any of these pictures, if any of them are still surviving, we're able to propagate from an earlier time t to, So, remember the general situation we were in now was we had t1 and t2. We had some path, some event, some set of paths, and we propagated the wave function from psi at t1 to psi at t2 using this propagator. This produced u of t2 t1. Thinking of it as a matrix now, not writing the arguments Q1 and Q2 explicitly. So what we can very easily do is propagate from an earlier time to a later time. We cannot easily propagate from a later time to an earlier time. That's related to this time asymmetry that was pointed out earlier, that we have initial conditions but not final conditions. So the operators that arise naturally in the sum over histories are those that go from earlier times to later times, and that's related to what's called time ordering, which I just mentioned. Again, more details can be found in the notes. But having, since we've decided that u will be fully unitary, we can actually formally define u of t2 comma t1, when t1 t2 is greater than still say u of t1 comma t2 with the same pair of times, we can just define it as u, define it to be u of t2 comma t1, which we know how to define. Just define it to be the inverse of that, because we know it's now invertible. And because this is unitary, the inverse is also unitary. And that means that the Hilbert space of wave functions that we defined at time t1 can be put in one-to-one correspondence with the wave functions at time t2. In other words, we can identify Hilbert spaces at t1 and t2. That leads to what's called the Heisenberg picture. And that's what's the natural picture for the path integral. Anyway, let me just to say one thing more about the Schrödinger equation, which is how it comes from the propagator. So that comes from propagating, taking these two times to be very close together and putting the identity event here, 1, so no restriction on the world line. Acting on psi at t1, and that gives you psi at t2, which is t plus delta t in this case. Now this is unitary. Because this is unitary, it can always be written in the form e to the minus I, some Hermitian operator, h of t, times delta t. So this is a general fact about unitary operators. If we expand that, because it's near 1, we can think of this h as being small. We can expand this one out as 1 minus I h delta t plus order delta t squared. Multiplying this by psi 1 and taking the difference, we see psi of t plus delta t minus psi of t is equal to minus I h operator delta t. Put it the other way. Minus I delta t operator h acting on psi of t plus order delta t squared. If we divide through by delta t, okay, then this comes out. This becomes order delta t. And we see that partial psi partial t is equal to minus I h times psi in the limit, and this goes to 0 in the limit in which delta t is 0. So this gives the fact that we had unitary evolution. Again, this is doing things backwards from the way you often see it. You often start with a Schrödinger equation with a Hermitian Hamiltonian, and you derive the propagator. Here, what came out of the path integral is the propagator. It's unitary, therefore it can be written in this form, and we derive the Schrödinger equation. What's missing, and which I certainly won't have time to show you, is why this operator H that comes out actually is the energy. Why is it expressed in terms of the canonical variables Q and P in the way that it's, you know, P squared over 2m plus V? That I haven't shown you. That comes out of the variational formula that you looked at this morning. So let me just list a couple of points which are key, which I sort of struck me more when I was thinking these things through for preparing the lecture. It struck me that two things is that what the path integral produces, the history-based formulation, it produces not a single Hilbert space, but it produces for you a family of Hilbert spaces, one at every time. To get the usual Hilbert space, so many spaces. To get the usual one, you identify them. If you identify them using the propagator itself, you get what's called the Heisenberg picture. If you identify them using just coordinates, same wave function at the same point, you at the same coordinate value, you get what's called the Schrödinger. I mean, this is very fast, so I'm not saying fully the story, but that's the basic idea, that the that you see we got from events, we got vectors, psi A in the Hilbert space. From events, we also can get operators, which were U sub A. We can generalize events to what are called functionals. We still get operators, which depend on the functional O. Okay. This is where the operators P and Q and so on come from. But the natural product, this is the other thing that struck me more forcefully, is the natural product is time ordered. You know, you can impose, you can propagate forward, and then you can propagate forward again via another functional, another event, and so on, and you'll get the product in the causal order, in the temporal order. But to get the products in the other order, which is what you're used to seeing in the usual formulation, you need to be able to pull the Hilbert spaces back from later to earlier times. That comes from unitarity. Okay, that's about, I think, so the two things I wanted to stress is that this time-ordered character, the multiplicity of the Hilbert spaces, and in order to get back to the usual formalism, the need to identify the Hilbert spaces somehow. And then the other thing which I said in words is that this was the Schrodinger equation formally. So the fact that H is equal to P hat squared over 2M plus V, and the fact that P hat is equal to 1 over I partial T, those come from the variational formula that I wrote down yesterday, which is integral dl dq, variation of gamma dt, plus p dq minus h dt. Okay, so that's a very lightning review of what I would have done if I could have gone infinitely fast and had infinitely long to do it today. But if you want to see the details anyway, it's more or less all in the notes. So, are there any questions?
Maybe let's thank Raphael.
Nice
lectures.
Yeah.
Maybe I have a short question. So you started with something that's more general than tentacles and the usual ones.
More general than the usual ones. Do
so you get anything new out of it?
Yes, you do. So ultimately the answer I'd like to give you is yes, we get quantum gravity out of it. But I can give you only a very small step in that direction. You can define a new class of quantum, what you might call generalized quantum random walks, which involve actually, in that case, involves a non-unitary evolution. The other things that you get, well, there's a huge class of things which you get, actually, which are, in fact, is very important, that they're not going in principle beyond unitary quantum mechanics, which is the evolution of open systems. So as you might know, if you're interested, for example, in the damped harmonic oscillators, which people are for very practical reasons, then how do you model the dynamics of this without? So it's damped because it's in interaction with some other kind of environment. That's what I've told you. People, there's various models. One is called the Caldera-Leggett model, one is called, it's related to something called the Feynman-Brand influence function. Anyway, there are various models in which you take this harmonic oscillator, this damped harmonic oscillator, to be damped because it's in interaction with a large bath, a very small harmonic oscillator, weakly interacting with
it. I mean, this is not.
And if you do it, then you get. And then you could trace out all the variables associated with the small harmonic oscillators, the vast harmonic oscillators. In this language, it means you integrate out over their world, all their world lines. You get an effective dynamics for the remaining harmonic oscillator that you're interested in. And that's precisely in this form. It cannot be put in the form of unitary evolution, now because you've traced out, but it still has the form, it still can be put in this more general form. So this decoherence function, or this quantum network, in some sense, it's the real case. I mean, every realistic system is never perfectly isolated and never perfectly unitary. And so it really always, in some sense, you really always work in this form. In that case, you could say, well, it's just a convenience, but it's an important convenience. It's just a convenience. Perhaps, though, as I believe, ultimately, you won't have unitary evolution at all, and then you'll have no choice but to use some formalism like this.
And then I do this.
What?